When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter the offer code INTELLIGENCE at the checkout. A better web starts with your website.
Thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast. For more information on our debates, talks, and discussions, visit intelligencesquared.com and sign up to the newsletter.
Why is so much writing so bad? Why is it so hard to decipher a legal contract or to follow an academic article or to understand the instructions for setting up a wireless home network? Now, there's no shortage of hypotheses, and the most popular is that bad writing is a deliberate choice, that bureaucrats insist on gibberish to cover their anatomy, that academics in the softer fields try to dress up their lack of substance by spouting highfalutin gobbledygook. I've never found this argument particularly compelling because I just know too many scientists and other scholars who have a great deal to say, who have no desire to impress, no need to obfuscate, still, their writing stinks. The other hypothesis that that's suggested to me is that it's digital media that are ruining the language, that Google is making us stupid, that Twitter is forcing us to think in 140 characters. Now, according to this hypothesis, it must have been much better before the advent of digital media, and those of you who are old enough will remember that age in the 1980s when bureaucrats wrote in plain prose, teenagers spoke in fluent paragraphs, and every academic article was a masterpiece in the art of the essay. You remember those days, don't you, in the 1980s, or was it the 1970s? The thing is, of course, that bad writing has always been with us, and one can see almost identical complaints about the quality of writing and the imminent decline of the language in every decade and every century, literally going back to the invention of the printing press. And yes, literally. I think that the perennial abundance of bad writing just speaks to the fact that writing is inherently difficult. It involves an act of pretense, and it involves an act of a great deal of craftsmanship, and that blaming it on the usual suspects, we have to think about what goes into good writing and how we can best improve it. I decided to write a style manual because I've spent the last couple of decades of my professional life trying to express complex ideas for a wide readership, and also because the ideas that I try to convey are often about language itself, and so I've got a dual interest in the subject. Where to begin? Well, I began by asking a number of respected writers which style manuals they read as they were mastering their craft, beginning with the other writer in the household, my wife, Rebecca Goldstein, who's published 10 books of fiction and nonfiction. And the answer that I got from every last one of them was none. Well, this was kind of sobering. What did I hope to accomplish, given that most stylists that I know didn't have the need for a style manual? It forced me to realize what the first prerequisite to good writing is, and that is immersion in the world of edited prose. I believe that this is a universal, that every great writer has spent an enormous amount of time consuming the prose of others. And Ian, maybe you can later divulge whether you were influenced by any style manuals as you were developing as a writer. But most, in my experience, have not. The reason that good reading is, and by good reading, it's not simply consuming the prose, but rather lingering over examples of good writing and trying to reverse engineer them, asking yourself the question, why did I just enjoy that sentence? What was so good about it? How did the writer that I am now reading have that effect on me? And I suspect that that is a universal in good writing, and there's a good reason for it. A massive amount of the English language consists of irregularity, of richness that can be absorbed in no other way but massive exposure. The English language has 500,000 words. No one knows all of them, but probably a literate writer knows on the order of 100,000 or more. Each word has to be acquired in an act of exposure and memorization. English probably has as many idioms as it has words. English has constructions. There are various tropes and gadgets and gimmicks and turns of phrase and paragraph structures that you can only acquire by immersion in the world of print. Indeed, many of the errors that betray someone as illiterate don't consist of breaches of any kind of logic or rules, but quite the opposite. They consist of taking a rule to an extreme. So if someone spells lose with two O's, for example, if someone uses an apostrophe in the possessive its, if someone uses enormity to mean great size instead of great evil, they are not being illogical. They are following perfectly predictable rules of English spelling, punctuation, and word formation. What they haven't done and what they're betraying about themselves is that they have not paid sufficient attention to the idiosyncrasies of the printed page. Another advantage of good reading as the first step in mastering the craft of writing is that it's a much more pleasant way to acquire the craft than to memorize a list of do's and don'ts. And many of the style manuals that I consumed have a kind of stern, censorious tone, that writing is an ordeal. It's a minefield that one has to tiptoe across, and one courts condemnation and abuse with every footfall. But consuming good prose as a way of becoming a better writer is a much more inviting means of becoming a writer anyway. The second thing that I think goes into good writing, and again, this is well before you get to rules of usage and errors and pitfalls, is to adopt the right mindset, the right act of pretense when you're writing, because pretense it is. Unlike spoken conversation, which is instinctive to us and which can be guided by the give and take of face-to-face contact, you can, when you're in conversation with someone, you can watch as they furrow their brows or raise their eyebrows, or they can break in, they can ask for clarification, and also the person in front of you is someone who's known to you. When you're writing, you're casting your bread onto the waters. You don't know who is going to be reading it. They're not there. You may be dead when they read it. And so you have to imagine who your readership is and also imagine what kind of communication you're engaged in. And the different styles of prose can be characterized by different assumptions about the scenario of communication. And I've been influenced by a wonderful book called Clear and Simple as the Truth by the literary scholars Francis Noël Thomas and Mark Turner, who differentiated a number of prose styles. And one of them in particular is, I think, the closest that we could come to an aspiration for general prose writers. And they call it classic style. And they define classic style as involving the following pretense. You, the writer, have seen something in the world. It's an objectively true happening. It's out there. Your reader has not yet noticed it. You are orienting your reader so that the reader can see it with her own eyes, and you do so by means of conversation. So the central metaphor is joint attention. Now, this might seem banal and obvious, but in fact, there are a variety of alternative styles, each defined by a different set of assumptions about what you're trying to accomplish as a writer. There's, for example, reflexive style, where a writer struggles to externalize some kind of subjective, idiosyncratic, and mostly ineffable personal reaction to events. It's a very different model. There is oracular style, where the writer sees something that no one else can see and announces his vision to the world. And there's a self-conscious style, what infects most academic writing, where the writer's chief goal is to escape accusations that he's naive about the epistemological assumptions underlying his own enterprise. And so a lot of academic writing is stereotypically awful because the writer is so terrified of being convicted of making an error that it is larded with apologies. And the concept of language is extremely difficult to define. There are many theories and lack of consensus and more research needs to be done and on and on and on before they get to say anything about, say, language itself. The goal of classic style is to try to discard all of the self-conscious reflections on how hard it is to know anything or to say anything about anything, but rather to describe your subject matter as if it could be seen by anyone competent to see, as long as they were provided with an unobstructed view. And in the book, I go over a number of sins of academies and other forms of turgid style, like bureaucraties and corporaties and legalese, which I think all are fall out of the model underlying classic style. And I'll just give one of them, and that is the academic's habit of compulsive hedging, to sprinkle your prose with relatively, in part, so to speak, virtually, as if to make it impossible to put you on the hook for anything that you say. Another reflex of this mindset is the mindless use of shutter quotes to ensure that no one ever thinks that you literally mean what you say. leading to absurdities such as the letter of recommendation that said, you know, so-and-so, this candidate is a quick study who masters virtually any task that she sets before herself. Now, are we supposed to understand that to mean that she's a quick study or that she is a quick study? That is, someone who is rumored or alleged to be a quick study, but who really isn't. And then there is the distinguished scientist who, when I asked her how she was, pulled out a picture of her four-year-old daughter and said to me, beaming, "We virtually adore her." Aww. The next step of in writing, and again, this is way before any consideration of the split infinitives, fused participles, and all of the things that people associate with style manuals, is overcoming a widespread cognitive limitation. It goes by many names, but my favorite is the curse of knowledge. The difficulty that all of us have when we know something in imagining what it's like for someone who doesn't know it. It's almost impossible to subtract a bit of knowledge and to do the act of empathy or perspective taking that allows you to appreciate what it's like for someone else who doesn't know what you know. The prototypical demonstration known to every psychology undergraduate is the false belief task. 3-year-old comes into the lab, is given a box of Smarties, opens the box, and is surprised to find pencils inside. So you put the pencils back in. Now Jason comes in, and you ask the child, "What does Jason think is in the box?" And the child will say, "Pencils." What did you think was in the box before you came in here? And the child will say, "Pencils." That is, once they know it, they can't imagine what it's like not to know it. Now, we outgrow the curse of knowledge a bit, but we are all victims of it. And I would say that after having the wrong model of prose communication, being a victim of the curse of knowledge is the main impediment to clear writing. It simply doesn't occur to a writer that the audience isn't familiar with the jargon or the lingo or the abstractions. It also puts the lie to the lazy excuse among many professionals, including but not limited to academics, that they have no choice but to write in technical language because it would just get tedious to spell out technical concepts every time. If you're in a circle of cognoscenti, then you have every right. In fact, there's no alternative to using a lot of jargon. The reason that I think this is wrong is that I am repeatedly bewildered by articles in my own professional field written for the likes of me that I still don't understand. And I know why I don't understand it. It's because they're badly written. And they're badly written because of the curse of knowledge. And I'll just give you one example. I'm a strong believer in examples because abstract descriptions really don't lead to comprehension. Good writing in, I think, nonfiction, as much as fiction, has to show rather than tell. Comprehension is not a matter of juggling words themselves inside your head, but using the words to form images and other much more concrete thoughts. So I'm flipping through an article in a journal for Trends in Cognitive Science, written for a wide audience of cognitive scientists on consciousness, and it says the integrative nature of consciousness is illustrated by the rabbit illusion, in which the perception of a stimulus is influenced by post-stimulus events. Now, I read that. I had no idea what they were talking about. I've been in this business for 40 years. I teach introductory psychology. I had never heard of the rabbit illusion. I don't know what a stimulus in this context is. I mean, I know what the meaning of the word stimulus is. I don't know what they mean by a post-stimulus event. So I had to hit the books and find out what... After a bit of digging, I discovered there's such a thing called a cutaneous rabbit illusion. It's a fairly obscure illusion in psychology, not in any of the intro textbooks. And it works as follows. The person closes his eyes. Someone taps him 3 times on the wrist, 3 times on the elbow, 3 times on the shoulder. And it feels like a series of taps running up the length of your arm, like a hopping rabbit. Hence the cutaneous rabbit illusion. Theoretical significance is that where you perceive the later taps depends on where the earlier taps were. So consciousness doesn't actually unfold in real time, but it's kind of edited retrospectively. Well, that's interesting, but why couldn't they say that? The word stimulus actually is no more precise than the phrase tap on the wrist. In fact, it's far less precise and less conducive to the advancement of science, because knowing that this is all about taps on the wrist and so on, I can then evaluate whether this really does show that consciousness is an integrative process. I can actually do some science where if it's stimulus this and post-stimulus that, I have to take the scientist's word for it, which is exactly how science ought not to proceed. There's a chapter in the book on grammar. This is probably the third most popular hypothesis about the cause of bad writing, is that they don't teach kids to diagram sentences anymore, like they did in the good old days. Now, I don't know if teaching kids to diagram sentences would improve the quality of their prose. I actually rather doubt it. But I think for an adult, much is gained in knowing something about syntax. Where that something has to be the theory of syntax as illuminated by modern theories of grammar, not the old Latin-based grammars that used to be taught and which are literally centuries old and which actually don't work very well even for Latin, let alone English. I think that it's useful to know, for a someone who cares about language, to know what a subordinate clause is, what a modifier is, what an adverb is, and so on. It can sometimes allow you to put your finger on what's wrong with a sentence when it just grates on your ear, but you don't know what the source of the error is. It allows you to profit from the advice of others. It allows you to push back when someone says, gotcha, you made an error there, and you don't think it's an error, and you can ask the copy editor or the pedant to say why it's an error, and then in many cases fight back if it isn't. And in many fields, ranging from poetics and literary criticism to cognitive science and logic and computer science, knowing the meaning of terms like predicate and adjunct and modifier, I think, just ease communication. I have a discussion of a aspect of prose style that is, I think, absolutely crucial, which is entirely neglected, as if it didn't exist in most of the classic manuals, and that is coherence. That is, prose craft above the level of the word, phrase, and sentence, but at the level of the paragraph or even the pair of successive sentences, the paragraph and the essay. How do you avoid non sequiturs? How do you avoid a sense of choppiness or disjointedness? How do you allow a reader to keep track of the players who are repeatedly mentioned across sentences? How do you introduce negation? How do you know what it is you're as what it is the reader is not supposed to be thinking, and how do you structure an overall narrative arc? Finally, the chapter that I suspect will get the most attention is called Telling Right from Wrong, and it is about so-called correct and incorrect usage. That is it a heinous sin to use a comma to join two clauses, to use the word aggravate to mean annoy as opposed to worsen or intensify, to use a fused participle, like I object to Sheila leaving as opposed to Sheila's leaving, apostrophe S, split infinitives, singular they. Did President Obama make a grammatical howler when he said no American should be under a cloud of suspicion because of what they look like, where the allegedly the plural they disagrees in number with the singular no American, and so on. Now, those of you who have sort of cocked an ear to issues of usage may be under the impression that there is a controversy between the so-called prescriptivists, those who tell you how language ought to be used, and the descriptivists, typically academic linguists who describe how language in fact is used. I argue that this is a false dichotomy, and in fact exemplify by what I'm doing in the book the falseness of the dichotomy. Namely, I am a descriptive linguist. I'm fascinated by how people speak and write, but I'm spending 300 pages bossing my readers around. The reason it's a false dichotomy is that while it is true that many of the so-called rules of usage, like don't split infinitives, don't use fused participles or dangling modifiers or singular they, turn out to be utterly bogus. That is, they do not conform to the logic of English grammar. They do not characterize the practice of the best stylists in English, and they never characterize the process of prose of the best stylists in English. A lot of them were pulled out of the out of thin air based on cockamamie theories of the English language, which are instantly refuted by any kind of literary scholarship, and if followed, actually make the quality of prose worse rather than better. This does not mean that you could just go ahead and write it however you please, because it's clear that there is bad writing and there is advice on how to make writing better. And that includes being sensitive to the expectations of a virtual community of literate readers. And what grammatical correctness consists of is simply the expectations of the audience that you want to write for. There is no legislative body when it comes to the English language. There's no English Academy. Nor is it true, as so many people think, that the editors of dictionaries function as such an arbiter or legislative body. I can speak with some authority on this because I'm a consultant to the American Heritage Dictionary. I chair their usage panel. And the first question I asked the editor when I joined was, so how do you guys decide what goes into the dictionary? And he said, we pay attention to the way people use language. That is, when it comes to what's correct or incorrect in English, there's no one in charge. The lunatics are running the asylum. This is, and again, contrary to a frequently circulated myth, this is not a new development in the writing of dictionaries, some regrettable product of 1960s relativism or of the influence of academia on high standards. It's always been true that dictionaries record usage. They have no choice. Words change in meaning. They always have. They always will. Any dictionary that carried out the purist's mandate to halt language change in its tracks would be as useless as the, you all remember the Hungarian English phrase book from the Monty Python sketch that translated, can you tell me how to get to the train station as may I fondle your buttocks? Well, any dictionary that attempted to flout the consensus among literate readers and writers and to dictate as opposed to reflect expectations would be exactly that useless. And so a dictionary that said that the word nauseous must only be used to mean nauseating, as in a nauseous roller coaster ride, and may not be used to mean nauseated, as in the children were nauseous when they got out of the roller coaster, would be useless as a guide to writers because it would misinform you about the expectations of your readers. That's true of dictionaries now. It's always been true. But in any case, I do offer some positive advice. It is really, despite the fact that some traditional rules ought to be thrown out the window, there are others that you'd be well advised to follow. If you, for example, are impressed by fancy schmancy words and you think that fulsome is a synonym for full, or that meretricious is a posh way of saying meritorious, you could get yourself into trouble. If I thanked my host today for her fulsome introduction, I would not be complimenting either her or doing any credit to myself, because fulsome to a literate reader means excessively and insincerely flattering. It's not a hoity-toity synonym for full. That's just one of many examples where a good writer really ought to hone an appreciation of how words and idioms and phrases are likely to be interpreted by a circle of fellow literate readers and writers. And that's why the prescriptivist-descriptivist controversy is just not a controversy. But in any case, just to sum up, even the most irksome errors of usage are, I think, a small part of what goes into writing, and they pale in importance behind adopting classic style or some other defensible style and having a clear idea of what that style is, the overcoming the curse of knowledge, and principles of coherence. So yes, pay attention to the fine points of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and diction, but the priority in writing consists of these far more psychological aspects of the writing mindset. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are we sitting too close? Well, I'm English, you're American. I know there's a different social function here.
Yes.
Now, well, we know that actually you do come bearing a whip sometimes, because you've confessed that you do not tolerate a comma split from your students, even in an email.
Yes, that is true. So the
But before we get to the comma split and the works of Samuel Beckett, I just want to sort of zoom back. I was looking at my shelves the other day, and you occupy just under 1 meter. And what's interesting about a writer's shelf, I think, is that it tells a story which you're not necessarily fully in charge with. It's an emergent story. And I was thinking, well, what is the narrative here? What is the paragraph, the sentence, the short story, as it were, that's emerging? And it helped me when I saw you described in the newspaper as a thinker, something I hope we could all lay claim to, but I rather liked it, very understated. It has an 18th century ring, and I'm going to quote from an essay you wrote when you say, and you're speaking... And it's why I like the term, but it has that echo of the Age of Enlightenment. And you say the great thinkers of the Age of Enlightenment were scientists: Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Descartes, Spinoza, etc. And seeing that and looking at your meter, I thought, actually, your project is one that was named after William Ewell, the 19th century scientist, and then revived by E.O. Wilson. Consilience. It seems to me you're an Enlightenment project man in the business of unifying all knowledge under one great roof. You did that in your personal life. You're a scientist who married a novelist. but more than that, you've covered the whole field of as an empirical scientist, and yet you've constantly wandered into the territory of the humanities, sometimes finding a pushback. And in fact, what your essay, that rather sparky essay, was some controversy involving scientism. So my first question to you really is, what is it that, say, the great revolution of our generation in the last 30 years of cognitive science brings to the business of language and grammar more than just mere logical, clear thinking. What, in your experience as an empirical scientist, do you feel that you're bringing to bear on this matter?
Oh, on the matter of writing style, per
yes,
se?
Yes.
A number of things. One is just the attitude of backing up claims with evidence. And this includes the traditional rules of usage. If someone says you may not split an infinitive, that Captain Kirk made an error when he said to boldly go where no man has gone before. It should have been to go boldly where no man has gone before. What I take to be a scientific mindset is, you know, says who? On what basis? What's your evidence or what's your argument that is a grammatical error? And this doesn't sound like traditional science. It doesn't involve sticking someone's head into a brain scanner. But it does involve what I consider to be a kind of a scientific mindset of, first of all, looking at the practice of actual writers of English. So it's a kind of textual or literary analysis, but which I would include under the large tent of science, that is, treating it as an empirical matter. Is it true of the English language that careful writers don't split infinitives? And it turns out to be false. And the other is a systematic theory of how English works. That is, if given facts about English syntax that we all agree on, the verb comes before the object, not after it, as it does in German. From that set of uncontroversial rules, can you deduce a prohibition against splitting an infinitive? And again, the answer is no. So this is as I think in all science is not just a listing of facts, it's an interweaving of theory and observation. And it's that mindset that I think can fruitfully be applied to usage.
You often take the part in your book of the reader, hopefully. So here we're in the area of cognition, and it's there, too, that I think you're being helpful in a strange and unusual way, because most books on English usage are not written by people who have a history in psycholinguistics and child development and child acquisition of language. Could you speak for the reader for a moment, rather than the writer?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, ultimately, style is an exercise in applied psychology. It's the psychology of the reader. When we talk about good style, we're talking about style that will please the ear of a reader, that will convey information. Many more permissive commentators on style who say, well, as long as you communicate, that's all that matters. Why should there be any fuss as long as the reader can get the message? I think we could raise the bar from that. I don't think it's just a matter of communication, although that obviously should be primary, certainly in prose communication, in expository prose. And I think in at least some aspects of literature and nonfiction, and in fiction, I mean. But above clarity, there really is such a thing as pleasure taken in reading. Not just I know what the writer intended, but I'm really enjoying this, and I think that can be an aspiration of advice on style as well. But both of them ultimately involve the psychology of the reader, and so I am curious and try to bring as much psychology as I can to bear on the question of what's going on in a reader's mind as she works her way through a sentence word by word and assembles chunks of meaning, forms images, ties together different parts. Those are all really, I consider to be questions in psychology, as well as, ultimately, this is harder to answer, but I think it's answerable, appreciates style as part of the aesthetics of reading as well.
Part of that aesthetic, you seem to underline, is in the clarity of logic and how things unfold, so moving from small things to larger things within a sentence or within a paragraph. Could you comment on that a bit? I mean, I suppose the old-fashioned manuals would tell you the same thing, but come from a very different position or background.
Yes. So one of the classic guidelines to good style. I certainly didn't invent it. It probably goes back to the Sanskrit grammarians. Is put the heavy stuff at the end of the sentence. It's the wild, the innocent, and the E Street Shuffle. Not the E Street Shuffle. The innocent and the wild. The faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. The heavy stuff goes at the end. And this is true at almost every level of linguistic structure. The polysyllabic word goes after the monosyllabic word. It's kit and caboodle, not caboodle and kit, and everything in between. Part of it is the meter, and I suggest early on in the book that good prose is enlivened by moments of poetry, that often what we enjoy, even in prose, is a pleasing meter, deft use of alliteration and assonance and allusion. But in addition to meter, the ordering of heavy last eases the reader's memory. Because if you've got a big, hairy phrase in the middle of a sentence, you've got to keep it suspended in working memory as you parse the end of it. That is, as you figure out where all the words should go in the logical structure of the sentence. And we know one of the basic principles of cognitive psychology is that our working memory is thimble-sized. There's a big bottleneck. If you put the heaviest phrase at the end, then you've figured out where to slot all the words by the time that you are trying to decipher that last phrase. And so that just gives a feeling of ease.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
That not only contributes to comprehension, but I think contributes to the sense of pleasure, that you feel that this is a well-crafted sentence when the writer shows that degree of consideration.
On the visual, which you talked about there and you unfold at length in your book, I had my own thoughts on that. Whenever I'm writing a scene that's, let's say, it's either violent emotionally or physically, it's very important to get the visual in the reader's mind, to convey to the reader's mind certain key visual facts, and then the rest can sort of look after itself. And I always think that the great remark of Conrad from his preface to The Nigger of Narcissus, my task, which I'm trying to achieve, is by the power of the written word to make you hear, to make you feel, but it is before all else to make you see.
Oh, I wish I'd known about that.
I'll email it to you.
Yes, thank you.
I always thought Conrad failed with Heart of Darkness. he doesn't show us what Kurtz is up to. And so he only suggests it. Not enough. But anyway, can we talk about the visual a bit more in writing? Because I think you really... clearly, you and Conrad have touched on something here. A large portion of our brain, is it 35% is dedicated to visual processing? or is it more or less? You tell me. We are visual creatures, and good writing always seems to have at its heart something intensely visual, even if it's dealing with abstract matters.
Yes, yeah, and even even in academic nonfiction writing, I think the major contributor to that, just feeling of kind of airy, mushy, turgid, bloated nothingness, is that the writer writes in abstractions. And the example that I gave of the stimulus and the post-stimulus event would be a perfect example. Yeah. Stimulus has a meaning, something that stimulates the organism, but just that word doesn't allow you to form an image of what the stimulus is. The image needn't, by the way, be literally visual. In fact, in the example that I gave, it was cutaneous. But nonetheless, it is concrete. It is a entity that one can that has a sensual component, and that carries with it expectations of how it behaves in the world. Once you know that something is a tap on the wrist, there's a lot else that you know about it.
Yeah.
Whereas for stimulus, something's very abstract. All you know is the definition, and comprehension is. Enormously easier if you have concrete material to work with. Probably because we build our abstractions as we learn out of more concrete experience, starting when we're children. And ultimately, the deepest and most intuitive level of understanding involves something concrete and physical. And a number of scientists have made this point as well, probably most famously Einstein, who said that he was led to his discoveries not by manipulating equations, but by thought experiments. What would it be like to be in a plummeting elevator, someone cuts the cable, and you take a penny out of your pocket, and you try to drop it, things like that. But I think in probably fiction and nonfiction alike, or at least in a lot of it, probably a big overlap that the beginning student who is one of the first things they're told by an instructor is stop being so abstract, be more concrete, allow the reader to visualize exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, I mean, Nabokov's famous lecture to English 101 students at Cornell in 1953, and this was addressing them as readers and literary critics starting out, was to forget themes, but to fondle details. And I think there, that sense of locking onto the specific,
yes,
and therefore the visual is very powerful.
Exactly. I mean, I make no pretensions to being any kind of analyst of fiction, but it's just so obvious when you're, especially when you see incompetent fiction. So my lawyer wrote a novel, and he asked me for a crime novel. It wasn't the plot, the characters weren't bad, but I could just tell, you know, again, being a complete ignoramus in literary analysis, but I could just tell from the first couple of lines what he was doing wrong. So he said, you know, the detective pulled up in front of a shabby house. I thought, no, you don't say shabby house. You say there was a rusting chain link fence half off one of its hinges and turquoise faded vinyl siding, and don't say shabby. Give the reader enough credit to figure out that if it's a rusting chain link fence, that's what you mean by shabby. And I don't think, you don't need a lot of literary theory to know that makes the difference between utterly incompetent fiction and something that at least gets to the first stage. But the same is true of nonfiction.
Did you invoice your lawyer for this advice?
Listeners to the Intelligence Squared podcast are eligible for a special offer with Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own website and online shop. The easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, responsive designs, and 24/7 customer support teams means you can create a beautiful designed website for as little as £5 a month. If you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code INTELLIGENCE to get 10% off your first purchase.
Let's just plunge right into the specific. And in my generation, I know educated readers who would never use the word hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute law against it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a minute, because there is the quality of knowing perfectly well that there are other sentence adverbs that we're happy to use. Sadly, he died. Frankly, you're a fool, and all the rest of it. But not hopefully. Someone has done something to our brains to forbid this. And even when you know it's nonsense, you don't want other people to think you're a complete fool.
Yes, right.
So we're in a kind of recursive problem here. Set us free.
Yes. So for those of you who are under the age of 50, maybe 60, there is a rule in Prescriptistan that says one may not say, hopefully the rain will clear up. You know, hopefully the sun will shine. Why? Well, hopefully may only be used for doing something in a hopeful manner. Hopefully Melvin sat down 6 inches closer to Ellen. That's okay. But one may not convey the attitude of a speaker. Now, it's a curious rule because there are dozens of adverbs that may be used in either sense, and it's always clear from the context. Candidly, you know, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. But why hopefully? Well, the historical reason is simply that it didn't occur to any English speaker to stretch hopefully from in a hopeful manner to I hope that until the 1930s. So for writers who were first exposed to it in the 1930s, it grated on their ears simply because it hadn't been used that way before. It managed to get fossilized into a rule, and what happens is that once a rule is in a rule book, it then gets copied by every successive rule book. There's an astonishing lack of originality in most of the classic style guides. And so it became something of a shibboleth, such that if you use hopefully to mean I hope that, you mark yourself as out of the loop, that you must not have been given the word that one may not say that.
But if you accept all that, but also take your advice that you need to assure the reader that you're a literate person and that you've read.
Yes.
And you've read, you might be giving the wrong signal.
Yes. Well, I think that there, in some of these cases, though, the change is inexorable, resistance is futile, and as the composition of the literate readership changes, it ceases to be a problem. That is, a generation of readers grows up not realizing there's anything wrong with hopefully, and you might annoy or lower yourself in the estimation of a declining slice of the demographic readership.
Right.
But that's okay. It happened in the past. I mean, another example, which I think the last objector to this is already in the grave, but the use of the verb to contact. Anyone got a problem with that? Now, if you look at some of the manuals, like Strunk and White's iconic The Elements of Style, they say, don't use the verb to contact. It's trendy, it's pretentious, and it's vague. You should say to telephone or to write or to get in touch with.
Be specific.
Be specific, exactly. Now, of course, there are often, first of all, this controversy is long forgotten because despite Strunk and White's best efforts, it went viral. A generation grew up and forgot about the prohibition, and now it's unexceptionable. And precisely because it is actually sometimes indispensable to have a word that is noncommittal as to how one person gets in touch with another, especially, you know, to email, to instant message, to text. We should be thankful that we have the verb to contact. And the last objector is, I mean, maybe there's a very elderly person in the audience who still thinks it's a newfangled innovation. And I suspect that's happening with hopefully as well. And, you know, you can confirm afterwards whether any of you still bristles at that use of hopefully.
If a language rule is much like an agreement on a standard for voltage or driving on the left or the right, as you suggest, what do we do with a word like decimate? 1/10 or 9/10. All we need is an agreement.
Yes, right. There, I think, well, that's, ultimately, it is an empirical question. This gets back to taking a scientific approach to language. And in fact, the dictionary that I'm associated with actually gets the numbers. So we have a usage panel. There are 200 journalists, novelists, writers, poets, linguists, sportscasters, people that we choose because they show evidence of using language with care, and we poll them once a year.
Would you actually... So it's a vote?
It's a vote. And if it's too close...
So the wisdom of crowds.
It's the wisdom of crowds. Right. And okay. Indeed, the difference between driving on the right and driving on the left and the meaning of decimate is that when it comes to decimate, there's no higher authority than the practice of a virtual community of careful writers. And if that changes, and sometimes it will change, then that's the final arbiter.
So what is the vote at the Heritage Dictionary?
No problem with decimate, meaning...
Nine-tenths.
Yeah, that's right. And the idea that this is somehow...
It'd be tough for a war reporter. I mean...
Probably not. I suspect...
To get this right.
I think that actually the horse left that barn a long time ago.
All right.
There was a... a New Yorker cartoon that shows a... By the way, we should probably give the background. There is a rule that says the decimate may only mean destroy a tenth of, despite the fact that virtually every actual usage means devastate or destroy at least nine-tenths
of.
And the idea is that since it came from a Roman practice of punishing a mutinous legion by executing every tenth soldier... The New Yorker cartoon shows a bunch of Roman soldiers, and there's one of them lying on the ground with a sword in his chest, and another one says to his neighbor, "Gee, that wasn't as bad as I thought." Now, the rationale behind the rule is that that since technically decimate, you can hear the DEC in decimate, it means a tenth, therefore it must mean destroy a tenth of. Dictionary editors refer to this as the etymological fallacy because it is simply not true that the original sense of a word is its only correct sense. In fact, that's false for probably the majority of English words. And as the editor of one of the editors of Merriam-Webster put it, if you insist that decimate means destroy a tenth of, shouldn't you also insist that December refer to the tenth month? And start correcting people when they use September, October, November, and December to not refer to months that aren't 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th. Usage changes, and we just got to get used to that.
We could agree that it just means to move the decimal point one yes, to the left.
that would make everyone happy or unhappy.
While we're being broad-minded, can we talk about the comma?
Ah, yes. There, Rich, where there, I'm happy to join the sticklers.
So here is the most famous opening sentence of a novel that was ever written, which you quote. But I'm going to read the punctuation as well. It is a truth universally acknowledged, comma, that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Now that's a breathing comma, what we
yes,
would call
breathing
a
breathing comma. Good
word. You call it something different.
I don't know if there's a name for it, but anyway, yeah, breathing, that's a good word for it.
It simply is a comma indicating, as it were, a pause to take breath, to just let it fold. And yet any editor would take it. Actually, I forgot to read the second comma. In possession of a good fortune, comma, must be in want of a wife.
From Emma.
Any yeah. copy editor would remove both of those.
Yes. Pride and Prejudice?
Yeah.
Okay.
Consilience has got some way to go yet.
Some way to go, yes.
You're working on it. The breathing comma is vanishing in favour, you suggest, of the syntactical comma, the comma that's dictated not by the sense of how you might speak this and pause, but by... the syntax of the sentence itself. And as someone who's been edited a few times by the New Yorker, where there is a fanaticism about sprinkling commas all over the place, this seems to me a great tragedy. I mean, I'm one of those people who see a decline in civilization in the way I shouldn't. But yes. This is a great loss.
Yes. The problem with English punctuation is that it really is shouldering two burdens. One of them is to indicate where one can take a breath, and the other is to give some hints as to the syntactic phrase structure tree of the sentence.
Yeah.
There are, and contrary to the idea that there is there are high standards for punctuation, and that civilization is declining because people flout them, particularly the grocers who use an apostrophe for apples, and so on. The Lynn Truss's Eats, Shoots, and Leaves was based on the premise that there are crimes against punctuation, that the rules are clear, and people increasingly flout them. But as it happens, that punctuation in Jane Austen's era was a kind of a loosey-goosey thing. There were all kinds of practices that often mixed syntax and prosody, or the melody and rhythm and timing of speech. There are differences on two sides of the Atlantic. In general, the Americans are more fastidious about punctuation than the English, and things like the comma splice, which always pops out at me, is not as uncommon in English prose. There's been a general trend to make punctuation, as Ian pointed out, a little less reflective of pronunciation and more of syntax. And the New Yorker has taken that to an extreme by inserting commas in places where an ordinary reader would just skate over that string of words, and the comma actually slows down the reader. It's like kind of playing hopscotch as you work your way through the sentence. And so the New Yorker has a famously eccentric policy of sprinkling commas at every phrase boundary. So is this a good thing or a bad thing? It's the way the language has gone. Oh, I should mention there's another trend, which is to lighten up punctuation. That is, with the exception of the New Yorker, which is bucking this trend, in general, copy editors now tend to take out commas and encourage their writers to do it, and as well as other punctuation marks like the hyphen.
Yeah.
Jane Austen would lose grades from an English teacher today or a copy editor because one may not, no matter how long and convoluted the sentence, put a comma between the subject and the predicate.
But she lives on. We're going to take questions from the audience. There's much to talk about. You're mostly addressing those who wish to write expository prose, non-fiction, as it were. But you are bound to be aware that, for those of us who write fiction, there was a famous beginning of Pride and Prejudice, the famous end of perhaps the most famous novel, is entirely without punctuation.
Yes, true.
Well, here it is. But I'm not going to read the whole 35 pages. But I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes, and then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes, my mountain flower, and first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breaths, all perfume, yes, and his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said, yes, I will, yes. It's amazing without punctuation.
Yes.
And how terrible it would be to insert it.
Absolutely. Well, that's if I could make a comment on that. This, it, in general,
sorry, the rules, this is Ulysses, in case.
Yes, and I knew that. I think it's actually a nice illustration of the point that all of the advice on usage has to be relative to the goals of the writer. And again, one of the things that drives me crazy about the classic style manuals is that they assume there's one way of writing, and these are rules that you must follow, and you're making an objective error if you flout them. Now, in this case, I mentioned classic style. The imagined scenario of the reader and writer in conversation, the writer has noticed something, wants to call attention to the reader. That is one style. It's not the only style. All the resources of language, the word choice, the phrase structure, the punctuation, the paragraph breaks, everything, are their tools, their means to an end that a writer aims to accomplish. What makes writing bad is not that the writer departs from one of these models, is that the writer doesn't know what he or she is doing. That is, the writer either doesn't know what the aim is or has an aim and chooses the wrong tool for the job. Now, Ulysses famously, is not the model of classic style. It is not that there is... The model of classic style is predicated on objective external truth. The whole assumption of classic style is there is a real world, it's out there, it's not subjective. Anyone suitably positioned could see it if only they're given an unobstructive view. Now that is, I think, a good model for a lot of expository prose, but famously, what Joyce was doing was couldn't be more different, namely giving a taste of a stream of consciousness.
Representation
of consciousness. Now, for that, the genius was to use the resources of the English language, despite the fact that consciousness is not a set of sentences. It's very hard to capture. But by eschewing punctuation and doing many other things, came as close as possible to using the resources of the English language to render a stream of consciousness. Now, he violated many rules of classic style, but that's exactly what he was trying to do. And he's a great writer because he did that. He knew what he wanted to do, and he used the resources of the English language to do it.
Any questions?
Yes, and the microphone will find you. Or do you want to?
No, you're interested.
I should do it?
You should do it. Okay.
Eva Kalesinska from the European Commission in Brussels. A question, first of all, for Steven Pinker, and a comment following up on, hopefully. First of all, the question. You said that there's no legislative body for English, of course, unlike such bodies for French and Spanish. But that doesn't mean to say there isn't legislation. And perhaps you might like to say something about Obama's move to make sure that people obey the law because they actually understand it and know how to fill in forms and obey various rules, regulations on their civic rights, that they should be able to do that because they understand what it is that's required because it's in plain English. Now, the Swedes are pioneers in this kind of work. They decided a while ago, quite some time ago, that you can't really have a democracy if people don't understand the law.
Well, can we let Stephen answer that on Obama? Because there are lots of people with lots of questions.
Yes. Oh, no, I think there are increasingly plain language laws, which I think are a wonderful thing for precisely the reason that you mentioned, namely if a citizenry can't understand the law or government forms, then there's a real sense in which they're being misgoverned. And so I'm in favor of plain language laws. They're very different from the rulings of, say, the French Academy in that they don't dictate such matters as the use of hopefully or the spelling and punctuation, but rather are guidelines much like some of the ones that go into classic style. Be concrete. Don't be afraid of using the first and second person. Use the passive voice judiciously. Avoid it in contexts where it gets in the way. Be concrete and so on. And sometimes test the wording to make sure it is comprehensible. So those would all be pushing in the direction that I'm advocating, even though they wouldn't be legislating on the structure of the English language itself.
I think we should let someone else.
In the back there, last row.
Yes.
Yes.
I've encountered a phenomenon in the last 3 or 4 years of people using however in the middle of a sentence to introduce a new clause. And it really, I can't bear it. I almost can't carry on reading. Mm-hmm. And am I going to find myself in 20 years' time completely like the people, the hopefully people? And what's your view on however in the middle of a sentence?
Probably what you're noticing is use of a comma splice. That is, since there's nothing wrong with beginning a sentence with however, your peeve probably consists of the person not putting a full stop at all the material before the however. So this is the comma splice I'll confess I'm sympathetic. It drives me crazy as well. However. I'm always wary of the phrase, "I've noticed it recently," because if you actually look it up, most things that people notice recently are not recent. And one could verify this either with by going to the style books of a couple of decades ago, and you'll find the same complaints. Or now, more recently, you can actually check it more objectively by going to the Google Ngram Viewer, where you can search a text string up to five words long in 200 words of digitized English books. Most contemporary complaints actually go way back. Now, your question is, the fact that you notice it and it's found, does it mean that it will take over and become standard? And the answer is not necessarily. So in a process that I don't think anyone really understands, it may be as capricious as other cultural changes like fashion and clothing. Some novel usages that are perceived as errors take over and become unexceptionable. They reach a tipping point, so to speak, like to contact, and hopefully is almost all the way there. Others, the preferred usage stands its ground for long stretches of time. So in the early 1960s, when the so-called usage wars began, or the grammar wars, because of the publication of a allegedly prescriptive, descriptive American dictionary, Webster's Third, there was a prediction by the literary critic Dwight MacDonald that by 1988, the dictionaries would accept mischievous, invidious, and nuclear as a pronunciation of nuclear. Because if you acknowledge that these errors exist, then the floodgates open, the ramparts are overrun, and the language deteriorates. Well, he made that prediction in 1963. Well, it's not just 25 years later, it's 50 years later. And I looked it up, and there's no dictionary that has mischievous, invidious, or nuclear. It is, even though there are some cases where resistance is futile, there are other cases in which you can go ahead and continue to stickle, and probably the majority of literate readers may continue to be on your side 50 years from now. We don't know. I don't know if the comma splice, which, by the way, is what irks you, is actually has been common in a lot of English writing before there was something of a crackdown. Whether we'll go back to the comma splice, I don't know. I tend to doubt it. But let's see. And is there anyone? Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
A good writer may flaunt the rules as long as they're aware of the rules and do so consciously, which sounds very reasonable. Now, if I think about the visual arts, there's rules in visual art, and artists may flaunt those consciously, like somebody like Picasso obviously has done so, but there's also a concept of outsider art or naive art, which is still considered to be good, even though it doesn't follow the rules and isn't aware of the rules. Do you think there's room for a concept like that in writing?
Oh, absolutely. And indeed, Joyce was an early example, but in many forms of experimental fiction, even more flagrantly in poetry. Again, going back to Joyce, it's really not a question of that the rules are inviolable, just that they're relative to the goal of the writer. Most of the time, a writer is trying to be experimental, really wants to meet the expectations of a literate readership, wants to be clear. And so the resources of language make that possible if they're thoughtfully applied. But absolutely, E. Cummings, when it came to capitalization, for example, another considered radical in its era, now kind of conventional, but sure. Oh, you're beckoning over to. We have a question. Oh, yes, Oliver Cam, the self-described pedant of the Times.
I'm Oliver Cam. I'm language columnist of the Times. Steve, you argue very forcefully, very brilliantly, that the idea that standards of language are declining is false, and it's been heard in, as you say, literally every generation since the invention of the printing press. What do you make of the idea? Is there any sense to the idea that standards of language are improving. I'm thinking of the argument of Otte Jespersen, the great Danish scholar of English grammar, that language moves to maximum expressiveness, and the more recent argument of Noam Chomsky, that language is perfect. From what I know of your writings and our discussions, I suspect you would disagree with that, but perhaps you could comment on it.
Yeah. I think it's a hard question to answer because there's no such thing as language. Language is used in so many different ways by so many different people for so many different purposes that it's actually an error to talk about the language. And that's one of the reasons why I don't subscribe to the idea that, say, Twitter is forcing us to think shorter thoughts, because all of us, each individual, uses language in a variety of forms, and depending on the context. You speak differently to your spouse over or your kids over the breakfast table than you do if you were delivering a funeral oration or if you were speaking on the BBC. And Twitter is just one of many registers or forms of language. And so to ask the question, is language as a whole getting more expressive? There are just too many different ways in which it's been used. One could ask the question of, say, in the language used in newspapers, even then different newspapers have slightly different styles and tones. So I don't think it's getting worse in that. I don't think the best. Maybe that would be a kind of benchmark.
But we are all writing more, aren't we?
And we are all writing more. Who would have thought, those of us who lived through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that the use of the telephone would be declining, or watching broadcast television? People are spending more time in the world of text than in the visual and auditory world. And of course, several decades ago, the Cassandras were lamenting the decline of civilization because no one was reading anymore. They were spending all their time on the phone and watching TV. Now, the complaints are everyone's at their keyboard. I think text, one could argue, is more important than ever.
You should take someone from the balcony.
Ah, yes.
Well, hi there. I was really interested in this difficult dilemma between he and she, sort of gender literacy. And I noticed in your presentation, and given that you're talking about the visual picture of conveying empathically a story to the audience, that twice, and I'm not a feminist, but I just noticed that twice you referred to reader as she and writer as he. And sitting down, I did notice he used he or she, and it struck me because in the things that I do, I have to stumble around being not only politically correct, but making sure that I'm conveying truthfully what I'm trying to say, and have this dilemma of he and she, and it's very clumsy. So I was just curious how you feel it's best to handle that.
Yes.
In that the old-fashioned way of just using man, he, is the generic for all of us.
Yes.
Pass by.
Yeah, it's one of many cases in which the resources of the English language just aren't up to the demands of writers and communication. So it's a case, to get back to Oliver Kam's question, where the language quite flagrantly is not perfect, very far from being perfect, because there is no way to refer to a generic individual without making some kind of trade-off. Now, there are a number of options facing a writer. The one that I personally used in the book was to alternate in chapters between having the generic writer being consistently he and the generic reader consistently she, and the other way around. And fortunately, I have an even number of chapters. But there are.
Did you design it that way?
Pardon
for
me?
That reason, partly? Did you design it that way?
I designed it that way. That was the choice that I made, and I explained it in one of the book's few footnotes. That's what I was doing. But I also discuss explicitly the array of options facing the writer. One of them is the much reviled but historically respectable so-called singular they. Everyone return to their seats. No American should be under a cloud of suspicion because of what they look like. And getting back to Jane Austen, I cited a paper called Everyone Loves Their Jane Austen, which went through her oeuvre and counted the number of times she used singular they, and I believe it was 57. And not just in the speech of her characters, but in the speech of the narrator. So Jane Austen had no problem with it. And I think that is one of the respectable options. It is neither illiterate in the sense of of contradicting the best practices of English writers, nor illogical, because the they in everyone returned to their seats is actually not in fact plural when you look at its semantics. It is basically, its meaning is a bound variable. It is what a logician would paraphrase as, for all x, x returned to x's seat, the meaning of they is x. And so semantically it's perfectly respectable. There are contexts in which it would clearly pop out and distract the reader. If you have, say, you know, a person should watch their language. If the singular and the they are too close, then that just clashes too much, and you might want to use another option of converting to the plural. People should watch their language. That's another option. Can also be imperfect, because sometimes you really need to line up in one-to-one correspondence the different clauses that involve an individual. Sometimes you may have no choice but to say he or she, and as long as it isn't done too much and the sentence doesn't have too many of them, it can pass unnoticed. But the option that is no longer available is to use the masculine to refer to a generic member of the species. And one of the, it used to be said that English, like other languages, he is ambiguous between masculine and neuter, and that's just false. It is just not true of English. He is unmistakably masculine. If you say something like, Jack and his sister had a game, who could find uglier pictures of himself? You know, that just doesn't work. Him is masculine. And when you read, the original objections to non-sexist language are that it pops out and it seems like the reader is boasting, look what a sensitive new age non-sexist guy I am, if you use, say, she, when formerly readers would expect he. Interestingly, in the 40 years since the feminist revolution, that reflexive reaction has been turned on its head. And when I read articles from the 1960s, say in political theory, that say, in a just society, every man should be free to express his opinion without being encumbered by other men, I do a double take. What about the women? And so our intuitions have changed as they had with contact, as they are doing with hopefully. And one is faced with an imperfect set of choices, each of which has advantages and disadvantages, none of which is perfect. And there's a more, I guess, a general point that I'll make is that when it comes to issues of usage, the great fallacy is that this is a matter of objective reality, and that there is a clear-cut, correct, and an incorrect way to express oneself. I think that matters of usage and diction and grammar are must be matters of judgment, like criticism, like reviewing, like making sense of an unruly literature. A writer has to make choices, just mindful of what the options are and what the advantages and disadvantages are of each.
We've got time for just one last question, and can it be phrased briefly?
And then may I ask you one last question?
Okay.
I think you're sounding at least as if you're overly sanguine about poor use of English. It struck me that it's really a syritic point. If certain cultures are using too much poor English, it will behave as a shibboleth, and people who look towards those people will, whether rightly or wrongly, judge them as being uneducated or basic. And it's really not terribly good to leave people with the impression that it doesn't really matter ultimately. It really is a syritic problem. It matters how much you do that, and whether you're intelligent or not, people will assume you're not.
No, I agree that part of being educated is writing to in conformity with the expectations of a literate readership. So the fact that some rules are irrational and don't contribute to clear prose and never did and have been flouted by the great writers of English and should just be expunged from the rule books doesn't mean that no one should pay attention to how they write. One can write clearly using, hopefully using so-called singular they, it doesn't mean that one should not be mindful of the grammar, the punctuation, the spelling of English. So yes, part of education should be improving the quality of one's prose, just that improving the quality of one's prose does not consist of obeying every rule that every purist has ever floated. And my question is, which style books, if any, did you read when you were mastering your craft?
Well, the one I still reach for, because I'm still
good.
Trying to get the hang of it, is Birchfield's Revision of Fowler.
Ah, yes.
Which I think sails very beautifully between the prescriptions of the old and an awareness of contemporary usage. And if I find myself in a tangle, that I cross the room and go straight to that. But anyway, that's enough about me. Stephen, thank you very much. Another elegant, beautiful book. This is, I think, our seventh public discussion in the last 14 years. Congratulations on it, and again, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can download more Intelligent Squared podcasts free on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you'd like to find out more about our events, sign up to our newsletter at intelligentsquared.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.